to Tuned To yesterday, bringing you shows from the golden age of radio. I'm your host, Mark Levionier, for an hour of drama. Two religious-themed broadcasts coming up. Later, we'll hear the third man's story on Quiet Please. But right now, it's the CBS Radio Workshop with a passion play called Son of Man. Narrated by Raymond Burr, we'll hear the voices of Herbert Marshall, Vincent Price, Victor Jury, and Robert Young in a play arranged by Archibald MacLeish and directed by William N. Robeson, a high-caliber cast and crew in this April 21, 1957 broadcast from CBS.
From Hollywood, the CBS Radio Workshop, dedicated to man's imagination, the theater of the mind. Radio Workshop presents The Son of Man, a passion play.
The words of the Passion and Resurrection are taken from the four Gospels in the King James Version of the Bible. The music is the music of Bach. There are four speaking voices. The words of St. Mark are read by Herbert Marshall. Those of St. Matthew by Robert Young, St. Luke by Victor Jory, and St. John by Vincent Price. These, with the music, make up the play. That is to say, the music has an actor's part, for Johann Sebastian Bach was himself a witness, not to the event, but to the meaning of the event. Of the four speakers, Mark, Matthew, Luke, and John, we know little beyond the words they wrote in their Gospels. These words, however, have much to say of their characters as men and of the differences between them. Mark speaks with the simplicity of an old man remembering what he himself had seen. The voice of one who had taken part in great actions. The Gospel according to Mark.
The beginning of the Gospel of Jesus Christ, the Son of God. As it is written in the prophets, behold, I send my messenger before thy face, the voice of one crying in the wilderness, prepare ye the way of the Lord, make his paths straight. And John did baptize in the wilderness and preached, saying, there cometh one mightier than I after me, the latchet of whose shoes I am not worthy to stoop down and unloose.
Matthew speaks with the force and authority of one who respects the past, one who has labored and lived among the people, listening long to their stories and putting the great narrative together with love and humility and passion. The Gospel according to Matthew.
The book of the generation of Jesus Christ, the son of David, the son of Abraham. So all the generations from Abraham to David are 14 generations. And from David until the carrying away into Babylon are 14 generations. And from the carrying away into Babylon unto Christ are 14 generations.
Luke's voice is the worldly but profoundly believing voice of a man who had journeyed much in the great cities of the Roman world. He was a cosmopolitan, an urbane and sensitive observer, to whom the narrative was true not only for the province of Judea, but for the Roman Empire and for the world. The Gospel according to Luke.
For as much as many have taken in hand to set forth a declaration of those things which are most surely believed among us, it seemed good to me also, having had perfect understanding of all things from the very first, to write unto thee, in order that thou mightest know the certainty of those things wherein thou hast been instructed. John testifies not by the witness of his eyes, but of his soul. John is the mystic, the penetrator, to whom the past exists in the present, and the present exists in eternity, and whatever was, still is, and always will be. The gospel according to John.
In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. And the Word was made flesh and dwelt among us, full of grace and truth. No man hath seen God at any time. The only begotten Son, which is in the bosom of the Father, he hath declared him.
The Son of Man, the Passion and Resurrection of our Lord Jesus Christ.
When the morning was come, all the chief priests and elders of the people took counsel against Jesus to put him to death. And when they had bound him, they led him away and delivered him to Pontius Pilate, the governor. Then Judas, which had betrayed him, when he saw that he was condemned, repented himself and brought again the 30 pieces of silver to the chief priests and elders, saying, I have sinned in that I have betrayed innocent blood. And they said, What is that to us? See thou to that. And he cast down the pieces of silver in the temple and departed, and went and hanged himself.
Then lead they Jesus from Caiaphas unto the hall of judgment. And it was early, and they themselves went not into the hall of judgment. Pilate therefore went out unto them and saith, What accusation bring ye against this man?
And they began to accuse him, saying, We found this fellow perverting the nation and forbidding to give tribute to Caesar, saying that he himself is Christ, a king.
Then said Pilate unto them, Take ye him and judge him according to your law. They said unto him, It is not lawful for us to put any man to death. Pilate therefore said unto him, Art thou a king then? Jesus answered, Thou sayest that I am a king. To this end was I born, and for this cause came I into the world, that I should bear witness unto the truth. Pilate saith unto him, What is truth?
Then said Pilate to the chief priests and to the people, I find no fault in this man.
And the chief priests accused him of many things, but Jesus yet answered nothing, so that Pilate marveled.
Now at that feast the governor was wont to release unto the people a prisoner, whom they would. And they had then a notable prisoner called Barabbas. Therefore when they were gathered together, Pilate said unto them, Whom will ye that I release unto you, Barabbas or Jesus, which is called Christ?
So they cried out all at once, saying, Away with this man, and release unto us Barabbas.
Pilate saith unto them, What shall I do then with Jesus, which is called Christ?
And they cried out again, Crucify him. Then Pilate said unto them, Why, what evil hath he done? And they cried out the more exceedingly, Crucify him.
When Pilate saw that he could prevail nothing, but that rather a tumult was made, he took water and washed his hands before the multitude, saying, I am innocent of the blood of this just person. See ye to it.
And he released Barabbas, that for sedition and murder was cast into prison, whom they had desired. but delivered Jesus to their will.
And the soldiers led him away into the hall called Praetorium. And they called together the whole band. And they clothed him with purple and plaited a crown of thorns. And to salute him, "Hail, King of the Jews." They smote him on the head with a reed and did spit upon him. And bowing their knees, worshipped him.
And after they had mocked him, they took the robe off him and put his own raiment on him and led him away to crucify him. And as they came out, they found a man of Cyrene, Simon by name. Him they compelled to bear his cross.
And there followed him a great company of people and of women, which, alas, bewailed and lamented him. But Jesus, turning unto them, said, "Daughters of Jerusalem, weep not for me, but weep for yourselves and for your children."
And when they were come unto a place called Golgotha, that is to say, a place of a skull.
Into a place called the place of a skull, which is called in the Hebrew, Golgotha.
They gave him to drink wine mingled with myrrh.
They gave him vinegar to drink, mingled with gall. And when he had tasted thereof, he would not drink.
And when they were come to the place which is called the skull, there they crucified him.
Third hour, and they crucified him.
And they crucified him, and parted his garments, casting lots. And sitting down, they watched him there.
Then said Jesus, "Father, forgive them, for they know not what they do."
And with him they crucified two thieves, the one on his right hand, and the other on his left.
And they that passed by reviled him, wagging their heads and saying, "Thou that destroyest the temple and buildest it in 3 days, save thyself. If thou be the Son of God, come down from the cross."
Likewise also the chief priests mocking said among themselves with the scribes, "He saved others, himself he cannot save."
The thieves also which were crucified with him cast the same in his teeth.
And it was about the sixth hour, and there was a darkness over all the earth until the ninth hour, and the sun was darkened.
And about the ninth hour, Jesus cried with a loud voice, saying, "Eli, Eli, lama sabachthani," that is, my God, why hast thou forsaken me?"
And some of them that stood by, when they heard it, said, "Behold, he called Elias."
And straightway one of them ran and took a sponge and filled it with vinegar and put it on a reed and gave him to drink. The rest said, "Let be. Let us see whether Elias will come to save him."
And Jesus cried with a loud voice and gave up the ghost.
And behold, the veil of the temple was rent in twain from the top to the bottom. And the earth did quake, and the rocks rent, and the graves were opened.
And when the centurion saw that he still cried out and gave up the ghost, he said, "Truly this man was the Son of God."
People that came together to that sight, beholding the things which were done, smote their breasts. And all his acquaintance and the women that followed him from Galilee stood afar off, beholding these things.
When the even was come, there came a rich man of Arimathea named Joseph,
which also waited for the kingdom of God.
This man went to Pilate and begged the body of Jesus. Then Pilate commanded the body to be delivered.
And Joseph bought fine linen and took him down and wrapped him in the linen and laid him in a sepulcher which was hewn out of a rock.
And he rolled a great stone to the door of the sepulcher and departed.
And the women also which came with him from Galilee followed after and beheld the sepulcher and how his body was laid.
And there was Mary Magdalene and the other Mary sitting over against the sepulcher.
And they returned and prepared spices and ointments and rested the Sabbath day according to the commandment.
Now the next day, the chief priests and Pharisees came together unto Pilate, saying, "Sir, we remember that that deceiver said, while he was yet alive, 'After 3 days I will rise again.' Command, therefore, that the sepulchre be made sure until the third day, lest his disciples come by night and steal him away, and say unto the people, 'He is risen from the dead.' So the last error shall be worse than the first." Pilate said unto them, "Ye have a watch. Go your way, make it as sure as ye can." So they went and made the sepulchre sure, sealing the stone and setting a watch.
And when the Sabbath was past, Mary Magdalene and Mary the mother of James and Salome had bought sweet spices that they might come and anoint him. And very early in the morning, the first day of the week, they came unto the sepulchre.
Very early in the morning,
when it was yet dark,
and they found the stone rolled away from the sepulchre.
And entering into the sepulchre, they saw a young man sitting on the right side, clothed in a long white garment, and they were affrighted. And he saith unto them, "Be not affrighted. Ye seek Jesus of Nazareth, which was crucified. He is risen. He is not here. Behold the place where they laid him."
"He is not here, for he is risen, even as he said."
"He is not here, but is risen. Remember how he spake unto you when he was yet in Galilee, saying, 'The Son of Man must be delivered into the hands of sinful men and be crucified, and the third day rise again.' And they remembered his words. And they returned from the sepulchre and told all these things unto the 11 and to all the rest. And these words seemed to the disciples as idle tales, and they believed them not. Then arose Peter and ran unto the sepulchre, and stooping down, he beheld the linen cloths laid by themselves.
Then cometh Simon Peter following him, and went into the sepulchre, and seeth the linen cloths lie, and the napkin that was upon his head, not lying with the linen cloths, but wrapped together in a place by itself. Then went in also that other disciple, which came first to the sepulchre, and he saw and believed.
Now when Jesus was risen, he appeared first to Mary Magdalene.
Mary stood without at the sepulchre, weeping. And as she wept, she stooped down and looked into the sepulchre, and seeth two angels in white sitting, the one at the head and the other at the feet, where the body of Jesus had lain. And they say unto her, Woman, why weepest thou? She saith unto them, Because they have taken away my Lord, and I know not where they have laid him. And when she had thus said, she turned herself back and saw Jesus standing, and knew not that it was Jesus. Jesus saith unto her, Woman, why weepest thou? Whom seekest thou? She, supposing him to be the gardener, saith unto him, Sir, if thou hast borne him hence, tell me where thou hast laid him, and I will take him away. Jesus saith unto her, Mary. She turned herself and saith unto him, Rabboni, which is to say, Master. Jesus saith unto her, Touch me not, for I am not yet ascended to my Father, but go to my brethren and say unto them, I ascend unto my Father and your Father, and to my God and your God.
Just heard the CBS Radio Workshop's production of The Son of Man, the story of the passion and resurrection of our Lord Jesus Christ. All of the words were taken from the four Gospels of the New Testament and were arranged for this broadcast by Archibald MacLeish. The words of St. Mark were spoken by Herbert Marshall, those of St. Matthew by Robert Young, St. Luke by Victor Jory, and St. John by Vincent Price. Introductory words were spoken by Raymond Burr. The music was extracted from the B minor Mass and the Passion, according to St. Matthew, by Johann Sebastian Bach. The Son of Man was produced and directed in Hollywood by William N. Robeson.
The CBS Radio Workshop, on Tuned to Yesterday, a Passion play, The Son of Man, from April 21st, 1957, on CBS. Archibald MacLeish, a well-known name on that series, producing one of their higher-end dramas called The Fall of the City, where they actually had a cast of hundreds of extras in an auditorium with Orson Welles narrating.
It is hard to return to the old nearness, harder to go again.
She's gone. We know because the crowd is closing. All we can see is the crowd closing. We hear the releasing of held breath, the weight shifting, the lifting of shoe leather. The stillness is broken as surface of water is broken. The sound circling from in outward. Small wonder they feel fear before the murders of the famous kings, before imperial cities burned and fell. The dead were said to show themselves and speak. When dead men came, disaster came. Presentiments that let the living on their beds sleep on
woke dead men out of death and gave them voices.
Masterless men, when shall it be?
Masterless men will take a master.
What has she said to us?
When shall it be?
It's an hour of drama on Tuned to Yesterday. I'm your host, Mark Levenier. And now Willis Cooper's Quiet Please, though often bringing tales of the creepy and unusual, we'll now hear the story of Cain and Abel from Abel's point of view. From September 6th, 1948, on the Mutual Broadcasting System, Ernest Chappell, our star.
Quiet, please. Quiet, please. Broadcasting System presents Quiet Please, which is written and directed by Willis Cooper and which features Ernest Chappell. Quiet Please for tonight is called The Third Man's Story. I have had a long time to meditate upon folly, and I think if I could live my life over again, this would be a better world today, dwelt in by happier people. For I think I would not have committed the folly of my youth, the folly that has drawn the lines for conflict and suffering that you are heir to now. My father and my mother, I know, committed a greater folly, but the punishment that was laid upon them was the sentence of an all-wise judge, and in the end, a demonstrable blessing, a blessing that might have descended unsullied to you of this present world, had it not been for my folly, which, among other things, led to my death. And to the death of countless other men and women and children and the laying waste of many a fair countryside through the years. I never saw the country where my father and mother first lived, but I've heard them speak of it so many times, at first with an aching homesickness that was almost a madness between them. And then as the years went on in my early manhood, with a kind of hopeless uncertainty, as of a dream once vivid and now dim and tattered in the years, never to be recalled and therefore a thing to be put away forever. My father, I recall him well. A tall, heavy man, a little stooped with toil, smiling slowly and saying little. His hair long and black. I did not live to see the gray creep in. A man of prodigious strength and temper. In short, the quiet-spoken, home-loving working man, father of all ages. My mother, the most beautiful woman I've ever seen. I agree I had little opportunity then for comparison with other women, but there have been many women since in this world, and none to rival her. Discontented a little, impatient a little, but a wise, loving mother to her two sons, and a dutiful wife to their father. And my brother. It is a good thing that my brother lived, that he was born and existed and strove with his hands delving in the valleys and tilling the broad fields, learning the secrets of the earth and the ways of seeds and plants and green things. I think he was the salt of the earth, although I procured for him a bad name, to my cost and the world's. He was a little older than I, the firstborn and naturally the first beloved, until I was born. I think he was more my father's son than I. He had my father's ways, his slow speech, his long silences, his giant strength, and my father's slow-kindling, deep-seated, terrible anger that smoldered far below the placid eyes and the peaceful countenance. Only twice have I seen my brother's temper flare, and the second time was my undoing. And yours. I think I was my mother's son. Perhaps I made it that way. I did make it that way. But I shall tell you, bear with me. We dwelt at the head of a valley far from the place where my father and mother had first lived. It was a humble place, but tall trees shadowed our house. A sparkling hillside brook ran gurgling down the hill not 100 paces from our door. In the summer's heat, the hills grew brown and barren under the sun, save for the plots below the slopes where my brother cunningly led the waters of a little stream, where the corn and the millet and the barley prospered. And the fruit trees on the hill above the house were my brother's, too. He tended them daily against the harvest of the fall, while I frolicked in the stream or lazed away the long afternoons in the shade of the plane trees. I well remember. I well remember the rains, my brother and my father toiling in a steamy downpour at some homely task, while I sat dry and comfortable under the thatch shelter and laughed at their dripping, mud-spattered labors. It was a good life we led. We the pioneers, we the happy family in the olden good days and the summers and the long, slow winters, in the cheerful spring and the golden harvest days of the fall. Pioneers in a smiling land, unpeopled by enemies, unmarred by discontent and hatred. So it was in the early days of my youth. So it could have been today, were it not for my folly and my death. The first in all this peaceful land. My father was a profoundly religious man, God-fearing and devout, remembering his obligations to his Creator with an intense personal fervor, laying aside a tithe of everything he possessed for the Lord, thereby engendering in me a mighty, impious curiosity. I remember an evening when my brother and I sat alone in the twilight, resting, he from the toil of the day, and I from the day's pleasures. "Brother," I said, "Brother, tell me something. What did you and Father do with the fruit and grain and things you carried away this morning?"
"We took them down to the grove, same as we always do."
"Well, what did you do with them there?"
"We left them there."
"Just left them there?"
"Yep, just left them there."
"Well, why did you do that?"
"Well, you know how Father feels. You know how religious he is."
"I know. But I don't understand why he does this. It seems like wasting things."
"Those things aren't wasted."
"Well, what happens to them?"
"They're a sacrifice."
"I don't understand that."
"Well, it's like this.
Well, go ahead."
"It's hard to explain. Your father gives you things. Food. Things to play with. What do you do?"
"I don't do anything."
"You say thank you, don't you?"
"Oh, yes."
"Well, this sacrifice is a kind of way of saying thank you for all the wonderful things we had. For the fields and the sunshine. And, for everything. For just living."
"Oh."
"We have plenty, you see. It's only fair for us to give up some of it for a thank offering. You understand?"
"What would happen if you didn't do it?"
"I don't know."
"Would something terrible happen? Would we have bad luck, maybe? Would we die?"
"I don't know."
"Well, do we just sacrifice what we want to?"
"We sacrifice the best we have, Sonny."
"Has it got to be the best?"
"That's what your father and I think. And your mother."
"What if it isn't good enough?"
"It has to be the best things you have."
"Can I sacrifice something?"
"When you're old enough."
"I'll sacrifice some wonderful things."
"Of course you will."
"And they won't be just old ears of corn and bundles of millet and stuff like that." I wonder if I thought, in my youthful folly, that the greater the sacrifice, the greater would be my reward. I wonder if I thought I could buy prosperity and happiness and the pleasures of the flesh, outstrip my father and my brother by the magnificence of my own burnt offerings. I wonder if this was the burgeoning of a thought that I might supplant my brother in the regard of my father and mother. For he was the principal provider. True, my father labored mightily, but it was my brother's strong arms that tilled the soil, my brother's active mind that planned the year's crops, my brother's sweat that procured the harvest that nourished us all. And as time went on, my father became more and more submerged in religion, And on his firstborn fell a heavier and heavier burden. And at the time of sacrifice, I stood sullenly aside, for I was empty-handed with nothing of my own to place upon the altar, with nothing to gain grace and prosperity for myself. I was young. Forgive me for that if you can. True, my elder brother had not many years over me, but I had been brought up in the indulgence of my parents. And since he was a prodigious worker, I found idleness more to my liking. I was awkward with the plow and the harrow. I bruised the precious fruit I was sent to gather. I dulled the scythe, and reaping time was sent away lest I bring further harm to the harvest and to myself. And the praise my father gave to my brother.
It's been a good year, son.
We've done very well, haven't we?
You've done very well, you mean?
What's the difference? It's all in the family.
Yes, but what we'd have done without you, I don't know. Why, we've got that lower field now that was all trees last year. That brings us a good crop. I wish there was something special I could do for you, son.
It's all right, Father. I like to work in the fields.
And those fruit trees, I never saw them bear so much.
It was hard work, but we'll have a pleasant winter.
Thanks to you.
We've got so much. I wish there was somebody we could give some of our plenty to. Don't you, Father?
We can give it to the Lord, son.
It'll be a mighty sacrifice this year.
All the better we have it to give.
But I wish sometimes there were some other people we could see, be neighbors with.
A day will come, son. A day will come. We may not live to see this world teeming with people, but we're the pioneers, and they'll live to be grateful to us. I'm thankful I have a son like you.
You've got two sons, Father.
Oh, yes, but your brother.
And I went away and sat brooding for a long time. Mind you, I love my father, and up to that moment, I love my brother. But I must find some way to outdo him, to win a greater place than he in my father's affections. But what was I to do? What tasks were there left that I could perform to please my father and to supplant my brother? I could not think. And the other thought, how would I ever prosper in life if I had nothing to give, nothing to sacrifice as my father and my brother did? My mother found me in the dark as I sat there sniveling at my unlucky situation. As I sat there dissolved in unworthy tears of self-pity.
Is that you, son?
Mother.
I've been looking all over for you. What's the matter, dear?
I don't feel good.
Are you sick, child?
I'm just good for nothing.
Oh, now, son. What happened?
Well, I can't do anything.
You can't do anything? What do you mean?
Well, brother does everything, and father tells him how wonderful he is, and I'm just useless.
Oh, come now, son. There's plenty for you to do. You always help mother around the house, and you're young.
I'm not either. I'm just no good.
That's a silly attitude for you to take. Now, what put all this in your mind so suddenly?
Mother, I want to be useful.
Well, you are useful.
I haven't got anything to sacrifice.
Oh, that's it, huh?
Yes. Father...
I know, dear. I didn't know you were so serious about things.
Mother, how can I ever get things if I don't have anything to sacrifice?
Get things?
Well, I mean, I won't prosper.
You poor child. You come in now and have your supper and you'll feel better. Then in the morning...
But in the morning, I wandered away, still downcast, before my parents and my brother had arisen. I do not remember what dark thoughts occupied my mind as I climbed the dew-drenched hillsides, wrestling with my problem. I do not know how far I walked through the morning in the hot sun of noon, nor where I wandered. I tired with the afternoon, I remember, and under a tall oak tree on the top of a hill, I lay my head and slept. Dreams haunted me. Dreams of my tall, laughing brother, rich and happy, surrounded by a cheerful and happy family in some far land. Dreams of myself, begging bread from a stranger, unblessed and unhappy. Dreams of poverty and want in a world I never knew. I saw myself dependent at long last upon the bounty of my brother, the farmer, the tiller of the soil, a laborer who had enough to sacrifice to ensure a good life for himself, while I suffered the pangs of hunger. And I awoke to the curious stare of a pair of tiny, grave little lambs, two little lambkins who stood and made bleating noises at the strange figure on the grass, who tottered to me and seized my fingers in their black little mouths and tugged at them valiantly. And so, when at sunset I made my weary way into the clearing around our house, I had found my vocation. The lambs objected mightily to being dragged up for inspection by my father and brother and my weeping mother. But there was a hot supper for me and barley meal for the lambs. And I talked bravely of the prosperity my new acquisition would bring to us all. I suppose I was meant to be a shepherd. My two little lambs grew. Presently, there were more lambs. My father taught me to shear them as they grew bigger. I found out the lore of the sheepherder for myself. It was pleasant on the hillsides with the tinkle of the weather's bell, and the flock grew apace. Ah, how I remember those long afternoons, with the clouds drifting lazily above me, the pleasant, drowsy sound of the sheep as they grazed peacefully around me. It was a lazy life, but a good one. I could laze away the afternoon securely, laughing to think of my burly brother toiling away in the sun-baked fields, fighting his eternal battle of the earth for his sustenance. I built my own hut on the hillside above the home place. I lived a pleasant, solitary life. Sometimes my mother and my father would toil up the hill to visit me, bring me cakes of millet or deep jars of sweet wine from my brother's grapes. There was an afternoon.
Well, son, you're doing fine with the sheep.
I'm glad, Father. This is what I like to do.
How many have you now?
16. But there'll be lambs in the spring.
I'm making you a nice wool coat, son, from the first shearing.
Oh, thank you, Mother.
I wish you could come home oftener, though.
You miss me?
Of course we do, son. That's why we come up to see you here.
But what about... Well, you've got a son around the house all the time.
He's pretty busy.
How's he doing with the crops?
Well, not very well this year.
Oh, what's the matter?
It's just a bad year, son.
What's the matter? Didn't he sacrifice?
I don't think I like the way you said that, son.
Why, I didn't mean anything, Father.
I hope you didn't. Yes, your brother sacrificed. You know he did.
Maybe he didn't sacrifice enough.
Yes, he did, dear.
Or maybe it wasn't good enough.
Son, it's not your place to decide what's good and what's bad.
I wasn't, Father. I was only asking.
The crops are going to be very small this year.
It looks as if you're the support of the family this time, son.
Me? That's fine. I'm some use after all, then.
Son.
Why, of course you're some use. You're a great deal of use.
More than my brother.
This year, anyway.
Son.
I can't help it, Mother. I'm happy.
Son, have you made your sacrifice yet?
Not yet, Father, but I'm going to do it right away. I'm going to make a wonderful sacrifice. And when the lambs were born, I made my sacrifice. I made a magnificent sacrifice. The lovely little lambs bleated piteously, and my heart bled for them, but it was what I had wanted to do. I chanted the old words of the ceremony loudly and joyfully. The black smoke rose to heaven. We all rejoiced greatly. We all rejoiced, except my brother. Now it was his turn to stand empty-handed and glum, although he did try to smile at me when I turned triumphantly away to look at him. The poor, withered ears of corn he put on his own altar looked very meager compared with the lavishness of my gift. And when, in an excess of good feeling, I gave him one of the lambs to offer up on his own altar, he couldn't even make the fire stay lit. I had to help. I was very happy. And I rue the day now. Yes, of course it was selfishness. It wasn't devotion. I was very happy. And when in the morning I left again to return to the hillside pastures, for my flock had grown and there would be much for me to do, my brother humbly came to me and laid a hand on my shoulder.
Is it all right if I walk back with you to see the flock?
Why? Haven't you got anything to do here?
There's not a thing to do here. Crops are in, but there is of them.
Well, isn't that too bad?
Yeah, it is that.
Well, come on along.
Thank you. I don't know what happened this year.
It is strange, isn't it?
You've done well. I'm proud of you.
Oh, well, you know, I told you I'd sacrificed something wonderful.
Yes, I remember.
I sacrificed the first lamb this family ever sacrificed.
It was wonderful.
Too bad your sacrifice was so cheap and bad.
I did the best I could. That's all anybody could do.
Oh, well, but you should have been like me. It's all very well to dig up the ground, but it takes something more to do what I've done.
I've done pretty well in the past, boy.
I don't see how you can expect to do very much when all you've got to offer is some old corn and stuff like that.
It was good enough for you for a long time.
Well, of course, but now...
I've worked hard all my life.
You don't have to work hard if you don't want to. I don't work hard, and look at me.
Yes.
I think Father and Mother are a little disappointed in you, you know.
They are not.
Oh, I think they are. I could see the way they looked at you. And at me.
I don't believe
you. And you didn't do very well with your sacrifice.
Not
even when I had to give you something to sacrifice.
You stop that.
I think your day's over, brother.
I told you to stop talking that way.
Yes, you're done. You were all right till I got started and made a good sacrifice.
What?
Oh, go on back and dig holes in the ground, you farmer.
You
do what?
You don't stop talking that way, I'll kill you.
Farmer!
Stop!
Digger in the dirt!
I told you!
Can't even make a good sacrifice!
You!
And I lay there on the ground. The sky had turned to blood red and the hills danced crazily about me. I struggled to rise again, but it was too late. I had loosed murder and strife into the good world. I had taunted my brother to the final act of death, and it was too late to say I'm sorry. Distantly, I heard my brother run away, and his cries filled my ears with sound. "It is more than I can bear," he said. And those are the last words of his I heard. My good, kindly brother. And through him, I brought strife and terror and hopelessness into the best of all worlds. And you are heir to the evil that I set free. I was my brother's keeper. And I failed my trust. The title of tonight's Quiet Please was The Third Man's Story. It was written and directed by Willis Cooper, and the man who spoke to you was Ernest Chappell. And Lon Clark played the brother. The father was Arthur Cole, and the mother was Alice Reinhardt. As usual, music for Quiet Please is by Albert Berman. Now for a word about next week, our writer-director Willis Cooper.
It's of course obvious that the characters in tonight's story were based upon people who did live. Next week's Quiet Please story is called, with a bow to the composer of our theme, Symphony in D Minor. It'll be the last of the Mutual Network series of Quiet Please broadcast.
Both Mr. Cooper and I would be grateful for your reactions. Until next week at the same time, I'm quietly yours, Ernest Chappell. This program was heard in Canada through the facilities of the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation. This is the Mutual Broadcasting System.
Quiet Please, on Tuned to Yesterday from September 6th, 1948 on the Mutual Broadcasting System. That wraps this hour of drama on 2 and 2 yesterday. Be sure to be with us next time for more great shows from radio's past. Until our next hour together, I'm Mark Levanier. Thanks for tuning in. Thank you.